Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands. Today, we're so excited to welcome Rachel Nichols to the show. Rachel is the host of The Jump, which covers the NBA every day for ESPN. So Rachel, as a girl growing up in Maryland, what did you want to be?
Well, it's funny, pretty early on, I wanted to do a version of the job I have, but it came in sort of a strange way. When I was in first grade, as maybe a six-year-old, they did a whole bulletin board like they do on the side of first grade classrooms, and you had to pick what you wanted to be when you grew up. And I was 6 years old, so I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up, but I already knew I liked watching sports on TV. And the idea of being on TV was just like completely foreign to me. So that didn't even seem like an option. But I knew I was learning how to write. So I said, oh, I could write about sports. So I just wrote on my little flower that they stapled in construction paper up to the bulletin board, I want to be a sports writer for a newspaper. And the more I went through school, the more I was like, oh, actually, I think that is what I want to do, and started doing internships pretty early and things like that. And the more I did it, the more I liked it. And that led to a newspaper career and then eventually switching to television.
Did you grow up in a big sports family?
I didn't. For me, it was like more of that escape. And I have an older brother and a younger brother. My older brother just does not like sports. Everyone assumes like, oh, your brother must have gotten you into it. No, I got my younger brother into it, actually. I grew up in the D.C. area at a time where the football team was really, really good. They won 3 Super Bowls from the time I was like a little kid, kind of that same first grade age of, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I think the whole town was so excited about the team being in the Super Bowl. Like, that's part of why it was so present for me, of why I wanted to do it. And it certainly, people had jobs that had to do with this football team. You want me to fill in my little construction paper flower that I want to be a doctor or a lawyer? No, thank you. I want to be doing that. And then they won 2 more by the time I was in college. So just having that really heavy sports presence in the town I was living in, some of the other teams were doing well at the time. And it just sort of was a cool escape from the rest of the stuff in my day-to-day life. I think the fact that my family wasn't as into it was kind of fun for me. It could be my thing. And then, of course, you know, I had a younger brother who came along who became a total sports nut, too. My stepfather ended up being a sports nut. So, like, you know, different family members come in at different times. But no, I mean, it was really generated by me, which is great because I think that helps me more authentically kind of be who I am now. It was just my own interest and something that I always thought was so fun. And it seemed, as a six-year-old, so much better than an office job. And it turns out I'm in my 40s. And that's still true.
How did you get your first internship?
So I did the thing that, Sam, I know you and I tell our kids, which is, no, just go do the work. And it doesn't really matter at the beginning. And I was lucky enough at the beginning that I could be 14 or 15 years old and not have to, like, oh my gosh, I know some kids who had to right away get a job at that age. And I was fortunate enough not to. So I could go to literally our local Penny Saver newspaper that came out at the grocery store once a week or something. And I went in and said, hey, I just want to like hang out and see what happens at a newspaper. I think I was 14 and I got coffee and ran the copy machine. I mean, I literally did all the stereotypical things. I don't think I wrote a word. I think it was just sort of figuring out how it worked. And then from there, I interned at USA Today when I was still in high school. Because again, I was just kind of fortunate geographically. They're based in Washington, D.C. And that kind of launched me into, once I was in college, getting internships I could actually get paid for, which was very exciting.
We want to talk about how you got to the NBA and earned so much respect from the players and coaches in the league. But what was that transition like when you moved from newspaper reporter to, you know, broadcaster?
For me, you know, as I said, when I was a kid, like just being on TV just seemed like the thing in a box. And it's so different for kids now because they have a screen in their pocket and everyone's on TV in one way or another, right? But when we were kids, it wasn't like that. It just, the barrier to entry was so high. And newspapers to me felt very real. We got the newspaper delivered every day. It was a great newspaper, the Washington Post. I really loved some of the writers in it. And at the time that I was a kid, the woman who covered the football team that I was so into was a woman, Christine Brennan. And I didn't know this until later, but she was actually the first woman to have a regular beat to be an NFL regular beat writer. The women had done it in bits, but not full time. And so it actually was a very groundbreaking thing nationally that she had this job. But to me as a kid, I just thought, oh, I love this football team, and the person who covers it looks like I'm going to look when I grow up. And I think it's a great example of representation mattering so much and sort of feeling like, oh, I see it, so I can be it. So I did that. And to me, newspapers were kind of always what I wanted to do. I read All the President's Men 200 times and worked at the Washington Post. And I got that job at the Washington Post, which was the thing I wanted. But over my 10 years or nearly 10 years at the Washington Post, the newspaper industry really changed. And just the budgets were different. The opportunities were different. And the change because of the internet, obviously, and the rise of cable television, and the opportunities more and more seem to be in TV. So I had been asked to do different television things on the side of my newspaper job to kind of experiment. Did I really want to do it or not? And my bosses at the Washington Post were good enough to let me do that, which I think was a big deal. And then eventually there was just sort of an inflection point where ESPN had a job open that was going to fit me both in terms of subject and geography. And I decided, you know, if not now, when? And I sort of took a guess, and it was a little bit of a risk just because I was good at being a writer. I had done it for a while. I had a lot of experience. I knew what I was doing. And in TV, I knew absolutely nothing what I was doing. And I felt like I had earned my way up in terms of covering sports. Again, been at the Washington Post covering sports for a decade, but I hadn't earned my way up at all in terms of TV. And the traditional route for people on TV is to start in that local market in, you know, some small town in North Dakota or Alabama, or just sort of, you know, some far flung place and then work your way up. And I didn't have any of that. So I didn't know if I was going to completely fall on my face on national television. And I probably did a bunch of times, but then I just kind of learned to do it a little less often, which is where I am right now.
Did anyone help you learn how to do it?
Yeah, I had so much help along the way. I mean, I'm sure there are successful people that do it completely on their own, but I wasn't one of them. I mean, there are countless people along the way, whether it was producers who sat and worked with me and said, no, this is how you talk on TV, to people just in the larger sense, navigating ESPN, which is a huge company. And sort of anytime you switch to a big company, it's a whole thing to figure out sort of all the individual mores and things of that particular place, to just sort of navigating the larger sports world. You know, I just don't know anyone in my business who hasn't had help. And for me, it was certainly the case of what's made me successful.
Was it different earning the respect of people from the Washington Post side, for example, versus suddenly you're on air, you have to gain the respect of the players, you know, standing on the court, you know, asking them questions? How was that different?
I think one of the biggest things was I fortunately was coming with a base of like respect in the sports world, and those relationships translated to me switching to TV. So that was good. I didn't really have to like refold and or rework some of my relationships with athletes or teams or anything like that. But I did kind of have to establish, and this took a lot internally as well as just what I projected to other people, of what kind of person did I want to be on TV, and did that person have credibility? So, for example, I am not blonde, I am not tall, I am not glamorous. These are all things that traditionally, especially in sports, if you're a woman, you had to be on television. I am 0 for 3 on any of those. So for a while, I tried to do like my best impression of that, which was to try to be very smooth and talk very glossy in a way on television and have my hair a certain way and do, you know, I unfortunately could not trick anyone into being taller. That never came off. But but I was trying to be this thing that I saw. And a colleague of mine who also is just a little bit different, unfortunately he's passed, but dearly departed, our friend Stuart Scott, who was not like the typical TV anchor himself, kind of pulled me aside at one point and said, "Hey, you're just never going to succeed trying to be someone else, because you could only probably hit like your best day at trying to be," and these are my words, not his, "tall, glamorous, and blonde. You might hit like 65 or 70% of that. And no one wants someone who's 65% of what they're looking for. You have to try to be 100% of you. And then hopefully that's enough, or that's different, or that's what somebody wants. And they think, oh, maybe I don't need someone who's tall, blonde, and glamorous. Maybe I want this instead." And that was great advice, because I was just never going to succeed that way. And for me, it was being comfortable looking how I look. It was being comfortable being, my manner is not to be very smooth and polished and glamorous. When I'm on television, it is very much, hey, I'm talking to you and we're having a conversation like we would if we were sitting at your kitchen table. And some people and even some network executives I've run into, that's just not their cup of tea. They want someone presenting to them and they want that in a more formal way. But there are definitely people who it resonates with to be feel like you're just more of having a conversation with your friend. And that is my strength, is to be able to make people feel like that. And it's genuine. And so it works a lot better than me trying to be something else.
Do you think it's changed a lot for reporters now? So for a woman reporter who's coming up to be an on-air NBA reporter or sports reporter, are the expectations different than they used to be?
Yeah, it is. And that's a good thing, right? And it's not, by the way, all the way where it would be or should be or can be or the way it is for men. So that's a bummer, but we're still working toward it. But yes, it's progress has been made. And that's awesome. It's been made in a couple directions. It's been made in terms of what you have to look like or sound like to be on TV. There are many more women now on sports television who are not all tall, blonde, and glamorous. It's not just me. So it just leaves the door wider open for more people to sort of be like, oh, I look or sound like this. And that's cool. That's a different approach I didn't expect. That's great. That gives me variety. You know, that sort of thing, I think, helps someone who's younger and starting out now, that there's just more doors open. And then also in sports, the sports world is different than it was 25 years ago. And women are just more of the conversation and more people that you would see in sports environments. So a young player coming in isn't surprised to see a female reporter in the locker room. When I was a young female reporter in locker rooms, they were all still very surprised and treated it was something to be commented on. And so I think if you're a younger woman today starting, to just not have that whole layer to deal with is great. But it doesn't mean it's easy. It still requires more work for women in my field than it does for men, you know, in general. Obviously, there's different exceptions along the way.
We talked about making the move from writing to TV and kind of rebuilding, the way you put it, maybe rebuilding credibility or, you know, defining who you are. But you've always been known for asking really hard-hitting questions, especially, I mean, in asking them of really powerful people, like asking, you know, Floyd Mayweather about domestic violence. Like, how do you prepare to do something like that?
I think that's the exact perfect word, is prepare, right? I think if you really feel like you know the information cold and you understand whatever issue you're digging into in a real way, and that you are asking these hard questions in a fair way that isn't just sort of a performance for TV. I mean, we've all seen it, right? The performative gotcha interview that's really more about the show than it is about the person they're interviewing. I think if you come at it smart, prepared, not looking to, you know, make your own hay off of someone else's answer, I honestly think then it becomes a much, I don't want to say easier, but a much more sort of straightforward proposition. You ask the hard question because the hard question is there. It needs to be asked, and you are completely prepared to, you know, kind of follow up if the person tries to evade it or throw it back at you. It doesn't feel as daunting if you've set up all of that stuff ahead of time, if you're prepared ahead of time and you know kind of what you want to do going in.
And what impact does social media have now in terms of knowing there's going to be a backlash? Whatever you do, you're most likely going to have a backlash.
Fortunately, I'm old. I don't know the nice, polite way to say that, but the real way to say that is, especially for being a woman in this business, you know, once you hit cross 40, like, you might as well have a walker. Like, I mean, you know, having been around a while, though, the advantage of that is you have the perspective that any minute or day or week of social media backlash will pass, and then guess what? Brace yourself, because in 2 months there's going to be another one. And in 2 months from that, there's going to be another one. And I also have the perspective of watching it with the athletes I cover. It's really interesting. You know, I covered Michael Jordan when he was playing. And that was right at the beginning of my career and at the end of his career. But it was obviously like a huge thing for me to have a day-to-day job where I covered him a lot. And he was amazing and incredible as an athlete and such a fascinating person. But during his career, while he was playing, he had a lot of critics. And we didn't have the internet then, and thank God for that in some ways when I think back on his career. But there were still plenty, talk radio, newspaper columnists, there were still plenty of avenues for people to be critical of Michael Jordan. And there were a lot of people who were very critical of Michael Jordan in certain moments of his career. Now, especially, I don't know if anyone listening watched The Last Dance last spring, that whole docuseries Michael Jordan's Bulls that was just fascinating. Even if you're not a basketball fan, it was kind of fascinating to get drawn into. People walk away now, you know, they love Michael Jordan. There's no one, you saw in the docuseries, you saw different peaks and valleys that are what I'm talking about of when, if you were there in the moment, the criticism. But there is, you walk down the street today, nobody cares that Michael Jordan went to Atlantic City the day before he played the playoff game. I promise you, you will not find one person on the street who thinks that's a big deal. In the moment, did it feel like a really big deal? Oh, yes. Yes, it got crazy criticism and attention. Days of people saying Michael Jordan's a terrible human, like he doesn't care about his team, all of this stuff, disrespectful to the game, like all the stuff that people like to say. Does one person care about it today? No, they do not. So I think that having, again, being old, having the perspective of knowing this too shall pass, and trust me, in, you know, X number of minutes, hours, days, there's going to be a whole new thing coming. You just can't get as worked up about anything because you would be exhausted all the time. I mean, it's just, that's kind of where I am on it. Now, it doesn't mean social media is always wrong or not useful or not an interesting tool for feedback or sort of seeing what people are interested in. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's connected us in a way, especially during the pandemic, that let us, especially on my side as sports fans, kind of experience some things together where we couldn't go to an arena and do that. But I just think it's like everything else. You have to know to take it with a bit of a grain of salt and not make it your whole worldview.
Are there anything in your work now that gets you worked up?
Sure, all the time. And then I try to kind of find my zen a little bit more. I think the past year and change, I mean, I can't believe we now have to say year and with coronavirus, since we're still going here. But, you know, I think we all took different things out of the last year and a half. And one of the things that I have been truly able to do a little bit better, I mean, I'm still, I think, just like most other women who are in the workforce, like you obsess over everything a little bit more because you know that every standard is higher and that you have to kind of keep things in a different way than a lot of the men we work with do. But I have been able to be a little bit better about realizing this isn't that important. You know, like, I mean, people in this country have been dealing with so many hard things now for quite a while. And this just, what's happening between two people who kick a ball around, it's just not that important. And so while there are things that stress me out and there are things that I wish I did differently and there are things that frustrate me because things don't go the way I think they should, I've been better at just saying, okay, it's a bunch of guys, you know, throwing a ball around and my job is to talk about them, which is even more insignificant than the guys throwing the ball. And it's all going to be okay. You know, I think I've been better at that. So I wish the last year and a half didn't happen. And there's been so many people who have suffered tragic loss. But if that's a given and that's just the way it's been, hopefully those of us who have been able to move forward can take the perspective of, okay, it's all okay. It's fine.
And now for a quick break.
I remember a few years ago when you called out Charles Barkley for using the term girly as an insult.
Yeah.
And I showed the video of you doing that to my daughter, and you've been like her hero ever since. I think that, you know, if more women like you use their voices, we would have so much less of the misogyny around. But it seems like you feel a huge responsibility to use your voice.
Yeah, and it's hard. Charles Barkley is a friend of mine and someone who has been incredibly supportive in my career. And I would, to this day, go to the mat for him and tell you or anyone else, like, absolutely, he's your guy. He's the one who has been supportive basically of women in a lot of other ways. So sometimes it's hard. It's hard. You know, there's times you're like, maybe I should just let this go. But it was in a very public national way. And it just felt to me like, hey, we just got to not use that as an insult. Like that's not okay. My daughters are listening. And to his credit, he took that in the way it was intended, which was two friends having a discussion. And I think there is a responsibility if I'm sitting in that chair to say something, to open my mouth when something comes up that maybe I would notice in the way one of my male colleagues wouldn't. And hopefully you just kind of keep moving the line a little inch at a time over to, hey, we're going to treat people with this level of respect. No, we're going to treat people with this level of respect. And that's always the way I phrase it too, because I definitely have some colleagues who'll be like, oh, can't say anything anymore. You know, that kind of complaint of like, well, what am I allowed to say? And I'm like, well, first of all, it's not about what you're not allowed to say. It's about what we owe to the people we're working with or covering or talking about or whatever it is. We owe them the same level of respect that you would expect. And so therefore, don't use some of these words. And then also my answer to that in general is like, if you wouldn't do this to your mother-in-law, don't do it to the woman you work with. So like that's sort of the larger answer. And in that was one of those cases. But it is hard. It's hard. You don't want to be the morality police for everyone all the time. It's exhausting. And that's no fun. So you do have to kind of pick your spots on what you say and when. But that one in particular, I don't remember the exact context, Sam, although I do remember the moment, just felt to me like, hey, it was worth saying something, but saying something in the context of, I love Charles. He's a great dude. He does a great job. And let's just use a different word, you know?
A lot of times it is an and. And I think sometimes we're afraid to ask questions like that because people see it as this like issue of polarity where like, you must be a bad person if you said something like that.
Yes.
But really it's just an and an opportunity to do something different. But on a different note, you met your husband at summer camp.
I did. I know. Yes, we were 14 years old. I always like to make clear for both of our sakes, we have not been dating that whole time through. He dated other women. I dated other people. well, I mean, you know, it's important to say. But no, the it's an awesome thing to be able to be partners with someone that you've known that long. And I feel incredibly lucky. He's an incredible guy. And, you know, it's pretty funny now that we have kids who are of an age to go to sleepaway camp because that's where we met. So, you know, my kids, unfortunately, their camp experience or what was going to be their first camp experience was interrupted by the pandemic. But not only are they now of an age where they could be going to camp and maybe meeting their future husband or wife, but you know, the camp we went to still around, still exists. And there are kids in their elementary school class who go to that camp, which is just really random.
What camp is it?
It's a camp in Maine. It's called Camp Laurel. And so the idea that we live in Southern California and our kids are in a small class at school and in that class, two of the girls go to that camp is just absolutely mind-blowing when we found that out and really fun and a cool part of our personal story, I guess. So yeah, we were camp boyfriend, girlfriend, and didn't see each other for like a decade. And then got back together, got married, had children, and got to meet Sam Edis at this elementary school all of our kids go to. So it's really, that's the end and moral of the story is that, you know, if you choose your camp boyfriend right, you can meet Samantha Edis. That's kind of how it
Which
goes.
Which is really all the journey
it's
that
really
we're
all
on,
anybody
finding a way to
wants.
Meet Sam.
Exactly.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like an amazing love story, born at camp.
Yes.
But what do you fight about today?
Like everybody else, we fight about all the regular stuff. And I respect him so much. I'm not going to start discussing our relationship on a podcast. But I will say that, you know, I am, and I've said this plenty when I talk about my work, and we haven't gotten into this aspect yet, but as a working mom and someone who balances travel and work and a high pressure job, to have a partner who is completely all in with our kids and does much more than I do of sort of some of their day-to-day stuff that one parent at least needs to be able to do. Cause I've been in four, when I'm talking to you guys, I've been in four cities in 5 days. I can't do that if there isn't someone else making sure my children have eaten, right? Like that's the priority. So yeah, to put a bow on that.
Well, it's so funny to say that because so often I have people, you know, asking me, well, I don't understand how you do it and I just can't make it work. And you're like, kind of look at that person. You're like, you're doing 90% of the work at home and that's never changing. So without a partner, either you have to be single or you have to be partnered with someone who believes in doing 50%. Otherwise, you're screwed. You're never going to reach your potential. And I think we don't say that enough. We give people all these tools and productivity apps, and it's actually a little more simple than that. It's like, partner with a good guy, partner with a good woman. Like that's actually what it's about.
Yep.
And I think that we don't talk about that enough.
Yep, for sure. Absolutely.
Do you talk with your kids about your career?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, Sam mentioned her daughters and I've watched Samantha in action. She's an incredible role model for her girls. And I have told Sam a bunch, my girls use her girls as a role model. So thank you for that trickle down. but it's true. And I think that, that it is important to have all those conversations. And it's both sides. We talk about all of it, right? So we talk about when I have to go on a business trip and I have to leave them for an important thing, like why and what that means and what that work will get me. And we talk about how one thing that I talk about my kids a lot is having choices, and that my goal for them isn't that they get into a certain school or have a certain career, but I do want them to put themselves in a position where they have choices, where they are not dependent, first of all, on someone else making the decisions for them in a marriage or in some other other way where they have no choice or no say, because we know plenty of women in this country, unfortunately, are in a position where, because the system is so stacked against them, they are then dependent on the person they're married to in a way where then they can't get out and have a choice if they want to. So I want them to be able to always have that choice. I want them to have choices in their job, right? That if they're in a certain company or a certain field, to have choices to be able to engineer a job the way that will best fit their talent or their life. To have choices, you need to work hard. That is kind of one of the main messages we talk about at home. And so it's a good sort of catch-all for why I have to go on a business trip. It's a good catch-all for why I have to, even once I'm home, and they're like, well, but you're home now. I'm like, great, but I still have to have this meeting, or I still have to do this on the phone, or I still have to be on my computer for a little bit of time, because it is, you cannot do the things that are the fun things without all of the work and hours and dedication that's behind it. So we talk a lot about that, and that it is going to be a trade-off as they get older and decide what they want for their own lives. There isn't just one way to do it. I obviously am very type A. I like kind of constantly working and kind of constantly having all these different things going on. I like succeeding at things. And so therefore I get the little, you know, mental reward, whatever it called, when a task is completed, whatever that like endorphin rush is. I like that. Not everybody does though, by the way. And that there are, I understand it's a little bit of a sickness you know, there are, they might grow up and decide that they want a different kind of life where, you know, they're outdoors all day, or they, you know, but that, and that's fine. And I want that for them. But the key, I think, when you're raising kids to come into that environment, especially young girls, frankly, and that's all I have, so I can't speak to boys, but, you know, to make sure they understand how the sausage is made and what's going to get them those choices later on. And then if they can, as far as I'm concerned, they can choose whatever they want. I just want them to be able to have those choices.
Well, what are your travel rituals? You're in different cities all the time.
Yes. Well, of course, right now, everything is crazy because of coronavirus. And I will say, shout out science. I have felt much better traveling since I've been vaccinated, right? Like, I mean, it's just, things are now, you know, you get on an airplane now. There was a point where I had to travel mid-pandemic, I would say, or early pandemic. I don't know, whatever you consider last summer was, because I was going back and forth to Orlando and the NBA bubble, which is a whole, by the way, different leg to that travel discussion, where you just didn't want to get near anyone. And if someone was sitting, I mean, even someone at that point, they were holding every other seat on most airlines open. But even so, every other seat still means that there's someone, even if they're across the aisle from you. Like, I mean, that's still much closer than we were told we were supposed to be. So it was very anxiety making. Now I have someone literally 4 inches from me. I mean, there's no open seats on airplanes right now. So there's someone 4 inches next to me. So being vaccinated has really changed that. That is a side note. Yay, vaccines. Yay, science. The larger question you're asking, though, about travel and just doing it in regular life is that, you know, before I had kids, I was a little bit more careful about, oh, I want to be on X airline because I was younger in my career and I wanted to, you know, the company wasn't flying me places in the same way. So I was like, ooh, if I get on X airline enough, I can get upgraded, you know, or like, oh, you know, I was going to New Orleans a decent amount earlier in my ESPN career and I love New Orleans. And it would be like, oh, well, okay. I mean, I'm supposed to leave on Tuesday. Well, I'm not going to leave it Tuesday at 9 a.m. I'm going to leave on Tuesday at 2 so I can have lunch first, because lunch in New Orleans is awesome. So I would do that kind of stuff. I don't do any of that anymore. I take whatever airline has like a freight crater out, I will take it. And I just try to get home as much as possible. So to give an example, I was in San Francisco on Friday. And then the same group of people was going to, I was working a game and then I went to go work a game also on Sunday. And all of the guys I worked with left San Francisco, and the next morning, or maybe the next afternoon, they took their time, as they should have. They had nothing else going on. Flew to Phoenix, probably had a nice dinner, woke up in Phoenix on Sunday morning, and did our work. I, because I felt like, well, from San Francisco to Phoenix, I have to fly pretty much directly over Los Angeles. Like, I will see our house. I can't do that. So I raced after our game. Our game was kind of early on Friday. It was a 6 o'clock game. So at 9, and the game went into overtime, which, by the way, you know, you start having these personal heart attacks that have nothing to do with which team you want to win. You just, as a working mom, are like, well, I need to get out because I have an airplane ticket tonight. So I didn't care who won the game. I just wanted them not to go into overtime. And then they go into overtime and I'm like, oh my God, my kids are already asleep in bed when this is happening. So they're going to wake up and expect me to be there. And what if the game goes into double overtime and I can't make my flight? So you start thinking about that stuff. then finally the game ends and it was great and it was a fantastic game. But I'm the minute my, you know, the minute we go to dead air and someone else takes over, I am racing out of the building. I'm getting to the airport and it was a 10:20 p.m. flight. I think I got to the airport at like 9:40 something, race through security, whew, get on the plane, get home around midnight so I can spend 7 or 8 hours on Saturday with my kids because I hadn't seen them in a few days. And then take an 8:30 p.m. flight to Phoenix. So there you go. That's my travel window in a nutshell.
Okay. If you had called me and said, hey, what should I do? I would be like, absolutely do not go back to see your kids for those 7 hours.
Because it's not worth it.
The amount of stress it's causing you is so not worth it. And they'll be fine. They won't even notice if you're not back till after the
till
next
Sunday
trip.
Night. Like, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's all for you, not for them, right?
Yes. But it is. And it's funny. That is such a great distinction. And it has helped my decision making, but that's what flipped me in the other way. So you're absolutely right. I used to say that all the time when I would travel, even when they were babies, and I would get some horrified looks of, you know, some people being like, I can't believe you left your twin infants at home. And I would say, my twin infants want to know if there's milk and a place to sleep. That's what they want to know. They don't even know if I'm there or not. But it was for me, right? Like, I would sometimes want to come home. For me, you want to hold your beautiful babies. Same thing. On this Saturday, it was 1,000% for me. And understanding that is kind of the key in making those decisions. But for me, I was going to feel better, even dealing with the stress and the juggling of the different flights and how it was going to change my day and then having to fly to Phoenix late on Saturday night and getting to that hotel at midnight. I still could make the decision that for me, having those 7 or 8 hours with them was going to feel better than feeling like I was sort of wasting the day traveling or in an airport or something. So I do think you're absolutely right about what the lever is. But then once that's the lever, you just have to decide what's going to make you feel better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you can make your next decision based on that too. And it might not be as painful.
It might be different. So yeah, but it is a lot, especially at this time of year when we're in the NBA playoffs and that's the main thing I do. So, you know, it's a juggle, but you know, I'm reminded there's so many working moms who do this kind of thing. And by the way, not just the people covering basketball, but the players also. The WNBA had a bubble last summer as well. And they actually, unlike the men's version, they allowed the women of the WNBA to bring their kids. And they had childcare set up for them. And that is something that is really remarkable, I think, that we need to see more of.
And now for a quick break.
Okay, so we're going to go to the speed round, and then Lou's going to come in with his final question. Amy, kick us off.
What book are you reading right now?
I am reading An Airline Schedule right now. I'm going to totally cop to that. I finished a book on San Francisco that I was reading for a long time. I don't know why San Francisco has come into this conversation for a while, but it was one of those like historical, it was like sort of the history of San Francisco from the 60s through now. It's called The Season of the Witch. It's very good. But once I finished and put down that book during the playoffs, no, I read basketball stories. I read watch replays of games. That is what I'm doing right now. And then I will pick back my summer reading once the NBA championship is awarded.
What is your summer hold?
This summer is really condensed, just like last summer, just because the NBA schedule and so many of our lives have been like kind of uprooted by COVID. So normally I'm done with sort of my NBA duties by early July. And this year, I'm not going to be done until early August or maybe even after the first week of August. So we will see. And then, of course, school starts when it starts, right? So we're fortunate enough that school starts after Labor Day. I know a lot of families, school starts in the middle of August for them. So we'll at least have a few weeks and we'll go back to the East Coast, see our families. We're both from the East Coast and just spend some time, I think, again, with COVID. Just the basic, hey, we're going home to see the grandparents, like that feels so nice and something we weren't allowed to do last year.
Who leaves you starstruck?
I think because I've been fortunate enough to be around a lot of really famous and accomplished athletes, I now kind of, it's the littler moments that I get more starstruck by, whether it's just sort of someone's story where it's someone in a high school gym somewhere. Those little stories you see on Good Morning America or something like that, where it's like the kid who was the trainer who became the this and hit the last shot, you know, those kind of things. Those really, I'll replay those over and over. But I also think I get a little bit more starstruck by people who have accomplished something specific. I was watching a Simone Biles video yesterday. Oh my God, right? I mean, have you watched that woman? And so I think the idea that like, oh, she is doing this thing in this space that I know was harder for her to get there than some other people. And she just did this specific thing I can see and be amazed by. I think that's more than a specific person being Star Trek, but more by specific accomplishments.
Something Amy and I talk about a lot because we're both so busy and momming a lot of kids, 7 between us. Amy has 4 kids. I have 3. So one of the things we talk about a lot is like our friendships don't look like all the other moms' friendships at school, right? Like they might get to see each other every day. And so how do you maintain your friendships?
You know, I think I'm very lucky. I have friends who understand that they might not hear from me for a little bit, and that's okay. And then we can pick right back up where we left off. And it has probably meant that I have lost out on having some friends who aren't vibing with that. And then I understand that too. Like I just can't necessarily be all things to all people at all times. And that's okay. I'm comfortable with that. And I'm very lucky. I have some very dear friends who have get me and understand my life and are patient with me. So that's been pretty great.
Lou, we'll let you jump in.
What I really want to ask is you see so many like crazy moments when players like lose their shit, you know,
that's
like
accurate.
Throw stuff and like, and like fight and like just lose their shit, you know? What is one of them that like took you back when you witnessed it? Like
there's all kinds of them, but I mean, yesterday I was in Phoenix at the Lakers Suns game and a fight broke out in the middle of the game and it's 10 feet from me and I'm sitting there going, oh, okay, I guess this is happening now. And it is a funny thing in that, and I will say in today's NBA, you don't have real fighting the way you did when I first started covering the league where people were throwing like pretty serious punches. Now it's kind of like the fake kind of, he pushed me. He was mean to me. But yes, even given that, even in the reduced form, and every once in a while, a real fight will still break out, there is no other part of my life where I see grown men push, shove, and hit each other. It just does not regularly happen at school pickup or in the grocery store or when I run to the drugstore for something or in my office. So, you know, it is a little bit jarring every time, as long as I've been doing this, as much as you see it, to be in a football stadium or a basketball arena or wherever you are and see grown men hitting each other as just part of what happens. I covered hockey for a while where obviously there is more fighting. And it was like, oh, these guys just started wailing on each other. And then 2 minutes, they're going to sit in a box, which is also weird. And then they're going to come out and just keep doing their jobs. There's no other part of my life that works that way. So like, there are moments where you sit there and say, well, this is a weird thing to do for a living, but it's also cool. And it's the reason why when I was 6 years old, I wrote it on my little construction paper flower. This is what I want to do when I grow up.
It was really interesting to talk to Rachel. I think I was expecting her to be a lot more maybe like high strung, because sometimes I think really ambitious women who get it done are like that.
Like us, Amy, we're type A plus.
Type A plus. But Rachel just seems like she's just really low key, and yet she just methodically has built this incredible career and an incredible family.
Yeah, no, I really admire how she's used her voice. And the way she speaks up is so level-headed, but so brilliant in how she shares her opinions. And I think it's probably part of what's led to her success. Is she's really impressive. I just like her so much.
We need to add Rachel to our post-pandemic dinner party list, Sam.
I'm writing it down.
Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Para, our social media manager, Phoebe Crane-Fuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.